Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jacob Kanzler and Mike Malott. A little later, Chris Hackbarth with the Michigan Municipal League will be joining us to talk about OPEB and dark stores. It sounds so sinister, doesn't it?
When you say it like that, it sounds a lot more interesting than when you have to try to explain it out. because then, and with no disrespect to what this how this affects people, but I mean, we're talking tax tribunal things and property assessments, and if you keep it at dark stores, it sounds very good.
It's kind of like what was it last year? We had the Death Star.
Oh, the Death Star bill.
Yeah, the Death Star. It was much more fun to call it that, even though it had nothing to do with.
I would say great way to brand a bill when it sounds a lot better than we're going to preempt all the local ordinances bill. Yeah. It's called the Death Star.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whatever you have to do to make things interesting in this town, you got to go ahead and take that leap.
Yeah, but that's what we have to do as journalists. So,
you know, one thing we haven't had to dress up at all is this Line 5 situation up north, because the imagination doesn't have to really be activated too much to think about what an oil slick would look like up north. I mean, because we've all been up north, we've all seen the Mackinac Bridge, and we know what an oil slick would look like up there, and it's terrifying to think about.
Yeah, you can't put that in your imagination, but the other thing is it's actually been illustrated a few times with what the oil spill would look like and cover. And so
the state, Jacob, you did a FOIA a few weeks ago, now it's probably been about a month now, having to do with a report that the state was going to issue. Remind our listeners what this report that the state had commissioned for was supposed to do.
So one of the things that the state, what came out of the pipeline safety recommendations, was to do a independent risk report and a alternatives report to Line 5.
And the safety commission was set up by who? Was that?
That was the shooty Dan Wyant. Well, the governor set it up, and arguably in response to a lot of the Line 5 stuff, which really kind of came as a head during the 2014 gubernatorial campaign. The risk report, as we all know now, was canceled a few weeks, I think even days, before a draft was supposed to be released because of this conflict of interest. They had the contractor had someone working on an Enbridge project at the same time as the state. So we FOIA'd for just communications between this contractor, which is DNV, Det Norske Veritas, but DNV, and the state, just to find out kind of what happened and what led up to this.
And this contractor, DMV, is that right?
DNV,
not to be confused with the Department of Motor Vehicles, which we don't really have
right.
In this state. Right, okay. So where are they from?
I think they're a Scandinavian company. I don't remember off the top of my head, but
okay.
There.
So anyway, so you FOIA'd basically all the communications between them and the state, and basically you got kind of what the draft report was looking like.
Yeah, so one of the things the state said, a lot of environmental groups were calling for the release of this report, despite the conflict of interest, just to kind of put all our cards out there, see what they had to say. I mean, this report was almost ready to go from all indications, but the state, because of the way it canceled the contract, said it never officially got a report. We got little bits and snippets of what the contractor was working on, including a draft appendix. I mean, a very tiny portion of what would be a draft. And so I did a couple stories last week where we found some, again, draft preliminary estimates of how much it would take to clean up an oil spill, which was one of the points of doing a report. And then also I've discovered some maps that were, again, very preliminary, nothing that anyone says is official, but just kind of illustrating maybe what a hypothetical oil spill would look like in the Straits.
And so what you found out then with these maps and these cost estimates, actually, it's kind of in the ballpark of what's already been out there, right?
Yeah, it's pretty similar as to what we saw. I think Enbridge provided the state an estimate a few years ago, right around the $1 billion cleanup mark, which is what my story was about. Now, Enbridge has come out and said that that was based on a larger oil discharge estimate. They say that really it would be 4,000 barrels released because of their safety issues or the safety measures. I don't know how much oil was being assumed in the story I did, but just wanted to put that number out there to show people what they were thinking about. With the maps, we talked to the University of Michigan a researcher named Dave Schwab, who has done the much cited Straits oil spill simulation maps, the ones that a lot of environmental people point to and say, this is what this oil spill could do. I had him look at these maps, and he said, nothing really different from what I did.
So basically, if the state had gone forward with this, and we'd actually had a report, it's very likely that this report would have just validated what other folks have already kind of put on the table.
From my indications, when you look at the cost estimate and also the maps, I mean, I think you can make an argument for that. However, the state will quickly come in and tell you that, maybe not tell you directly, but it's implied that the political fallout of having this report any more tainted with Enbridge than they should would render it a junk report, and that's why they got rid of it. I think they want this to have as clean a slate as possible so that there can be a decision that everyone can rest on and say, this is why we're going to do this or that.
Okay, so now we're going to do a risk report with Michigan Tech. Is that right?
And a variety. Michigan Tech will lead it with a number of university experts that include Dave Schwab, likely from U of M.
Is it possible that this group could be tainted as well, though? I mean, is there any clean hands when it comes to Enbridge? Because Enbridge is so involved in so many different aspects of environmental pipeline type traffic.
Yeah, maybe not just that, but the fact that the people that know how to do this stuff to assess a risk of a pipeline, it's likely that they need to have some working knowledge of the field, and it's likely that they may have worked with Enbridge because of their reach across North America. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how you are truly independent where you have not worked for an oil company or consulted with an oil company in this area. So the Michigan Tech researcher who is leading this has done some contract work with Enbridge before. But their argument that I'm hearing from him in the state is that because this is a university, that's all out there, it's all transparent, we're all hearing about it right now. We're not beholden to them by any chance, but we're just making sure you have all the cards on the table. And so they're kind of letting the public judge. Well, because I asked Guy Meadows, I was like, do you think that after you've talked about your contract work with Enbridge, do you think that the same conflict of interest issues would come up? And he said, people might think that, but it's up for them to decide. And so they're kind of doing we're going to put all our cards on the table. This is what we have. We have nothing to hide. And you decide if this is something that is an issue. But I guess the question is, does the state want to invest all that time? And again, if someone's going to raise this as an issue when the report comes out.
You know what this sounds like to me, Jacob? This sounds like the state running out the clock is what it sounds like to me. I mean, couldn't you make this argument? I mean, Snyder, Schuette, you've got 15 months left on your tenure. You don't really want to do anything on this issue, but you don't want to ignore it either. So you keep moving these studies around. Oh, we've got a conflict here. Maybe we don't have a conflict there. And then in the end, oh, geez, now we're into campaign season. Now it's a political issue. Oh, now my term's done. It just kind of seems to me this is running out the clock.
That is a criticism the state has taken. It's something that they appear to be taking very seriously, which is why they are pushing Guy Meadows to keep to a 6-month timeline when they negotiate a contract, which the contract, as far as I know, has not been negotiated yet. And they made this decision close to a month, maybe almost 2 months now, since the pipeline meeting.
Who's Guy Meadows again?
The Michigan Tech guy. Who's going to be leading the study. And so,
cool name, man.
Certainly, it's taking a long time, and it's something that the environmental community is concerned about. It's something that the Pipeline Safety Board has also raised issues about. And so there's that theory. There's also the theory that, the state wants to have as much information, as solid as a foundation to make a decision off of. The question is, when is that going to come?
And then the whole thing, too, about... Doesn't the federal government have final oversight on this? I mean, if the state could try and shut them down, and Enbridge was like would take them to court and say, well, you know what, we've got the Commerce Clause, or we got something else, and you guys can't do squat anyway.
I think the feds have jurisdiction over pipelines, but where people have focused on the state is that the easement of land granted. So that would be another issue that needs to be sorted out.
We're going to have to bring in the staff attorney for that one. We're going to change subjects here, Mike. Let's talk a little bit about this auto insurance debate. Whether this comes out on the floor this week or not, there's some rumblings that that's possible, but the speaker is going to need some Democratic votes. And you took a look at this all last week. And so far, how many Dem yes votes solid do we have right now? You had Leslie Love say.
Leslie Love said she was definite, and Phil Phelps told me that he likes it in concept, but he's got some technical issues with it. He'd need an amendment before he could vote for it.
There's a lot of people out there that maybe would vote yes if it were up on the board, but it's probably not their first choice, and they'd like to make some changes to it. But if push comes to shove and their light is up on the board, that number could grow because there's a lot of different considerations here, both political and policy, mostly on the political front, I would say.
Right. It's going to be very hard for people in districts where the insurance rates are high for somebody to put red up there on the board so that they'll have to explain to their residents why they voted against lowering their rates.
And let's take a look at some folks in particular. Let's take a look at Sylvia Santana. She's going to be running for the state Senate. I mean, does she want to go around and explain why she was a no vote on lowering car insurance rates when you know she's going to have a primary, right?
Right.
And, I mean, the same thing could be said when you move outward. You take a look at, let's say, a Kosowski or an Erica Geis. They're going to be running against each other. Who wants to say, I'm the one who voted yes to lower your car insurance rates? And if you want to go...
I think the fear is that they'll have to say and be explaining why they voted no against lowering rates. But do keep in mind that there's an alternative there. There's another package in there. And the argument is that if you look at what's in that package, then rates could be lowered, maybe not quite as much, 20 to 30% as opposed to 30 to 40 under the Leonard Duggan plan. You could get a little bit of savings there in an alternative without getting rid of the personal injury protection, the unlimited form that we have now.
Yeah, but that took you 30 seconds to explain. And it only takes me 5 seconds to say you voted no on cutting our auto insurance rates. And
that's
I think
true.
That's where some of these folks are going to come into a problem. And taking a look at some of these folks who are going to be running for the state Senate in competitive districts, Henry Yanez, Scott Deanda, who we had on this podcast last week, Winnie Brinks, are they comfortable enough to vote no on this and face the repercussions? And it's particularly if you represent more blue-collar areas, let's say like a Darren Camilleri or something like, you know, somebody who represents more blue-collar area where auto insurance are more of an impact to your pocketbook than somebody, let's say, Donna Lozinski, who's in a more well-to-do area where the amount of the coverage may mean more to you than the extra 100 or 200 or, you know, whatever bucks every 6 months.
That's all true, but you also have to keep in mind that the lowest level, the tier that gets you the biggest savings is a $250,000 cap, and that's for the medical. The other expenses are even less. Representative Gay Dagnogo calls it the poverty level tier. And she points out that if you've got $250,000 level coverage, you're almost guaranteed to be going bankrupt. So if that's the option that saves you money, the only option that saves you money, and they haven't said that the other options will guarantee a rate reduction, you're almost guaranteeing yourself, if you have a bad accident, that you're going to end up on Medicaid, which, oh, by the way, is a target in Washington as well.
Well, that's very true. And I think the folks in Detroit may have a better argument to vote no, because they can go with the whole redlining argument, which does play with their constituents. They can say Lansing doesn't want to target redlining. They still want to punish us for living in the city of Detroit by not smoothing out the rates across the state. So you have an argument in the city of Detroit, but once you get out of those city boundaries, you don't have that redlining argument you can make anymore. And that's where I think folks like a Representative Hammoud have some problems, because you can't make that argument in his district. You don't have that fallback that's well entrenched in the voting public there in the city of Dearborn. All they know is they pay the second highest rates in the entire state of Michigan. And what have you done about it, Representative?
And so this is almost breaking down to a district by district zip code by zip code
right.
breakdown as to who is going to end up voting. Very difficult to call right now.
Well, and here's the thing, too, about Tom Leonard. Since he's done this before, he could put the vote up on the board and panic people into thinking that he's going to close the board. But just because you put a vote up on the board doesn't mean you can't clear the board. And so this is a tactic that he may do just to see where everyone's at. Is he could just go ahead and call a vote and see how many votes he's short, clear the board, and then go after specific people, and then see if he can come back and get it again. And at any time, though, realizing if you're a red on that board, that he could close it at any time. And that may frighten some people into going ahead and voting yes. And maybe that fear factor is what gets him the 55 votes needed.
Yeah, something smart out there as a spreadsheet, because with that tactic, if you are going after votes and you see someone's prospective primary opponent or general election presumed opponent, vote yes. Man, you had better vote yes, because that will be the issue in your election, I would say.
Oh, yeah. I got to believe it. All right. So anyway, we'll see what the unpredictable Tom Leonard does on this week, and I'm sure we'll check in on it next week. We're going to move on to the interview portion here with Chris Ackbarth. Joining us now for the podcast is Chris Ackbarth. He is with the Michigan Municipal League. We are at the a remote location today, Chris, at your own office here. Good morning. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Morning, Kyle. Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's talk about last week's decision involving Menards versus Escanaba. How big was this decision for you guys?
It was an affirmation of an awesome decision. So the Court of Appeals had already decided in the city of Escanaba's favor, and it was a perfect decision. It was exactly what we have been saying all along, that every property is unique and must be looked at in a unique way, individually. You can't do a one-size-fits-all valuation for every big box store out there. Court of Appeals had agreed with that. This was just an affirmation by the Supreme Court that the Court of Appeals decision was right.
Now, are we going to need legislation now?
It never hurts to have legislation that codifies a court decision. But I think, for now, we want to see what the fallout is when this goes back to the tribunal, how the tribunal decides, and see what's out there. I think there is still a need, especially when you look at the deed restriction piece, that guidance on disallowing deed restrictions from being self-imposed, creating this loophole for yourself where you can lower your own taxes, that's one that we really should drive a stake through.
You know, for our listeners who aren't maybe familiar with this, why was this an important decision? This basically means that local governments have additional tax revenue that maybe they weren't getting right now, correct?
Well, what it is it's just about basic fairness in how property is valued. When you look at every valuation expert across the country, they're all trained the same way. They all look at whether a building is valued based upon the cost approach, what it costs to build it, the sales approach, what other comparable properties go for, or the income approach, how much income are they making off of that property. And each one is unique in terms of the mix of those three valuation methods. What the tribunal had done originally in this Escanaba case was to throw the other two out the window and say, everything we do is going to be driven by the sales approach, and we're going to allow deed restrictions for dark, blighted stores halfway across the state to count as a comparable sale, and that's not real life, and that's what this decision gets everything back to an even keel, a fair playing field.
Because how I looked at it is that this was allowing big box stores like a Menards or a Best Buy or something like that, or a Home Depot, to say this is what our property would be worth if it was empty, and. And these box stores aren't empty. They're actually selling something.
Correct. Well, and you even had situations where we had brand new stores being built. They weren't even open yet, and they were asking to be valued at the level of a vacant, blighted store in another part of the state.
like that, let's say that Kmart on Cedar Street down there.
Right.
That's a comparable property to, let's say, the Home Depot on Waverly, which is doing pretty well.
That's the argument they tried to make, and they had been making that argument for a while until this decision.
Another issue that you are dealing with right now that I imagine will get a little bit of attention near the end of the year is this, what we call OPEB, but this is retiree municipal employee health care. I mean, that's basically what we're talking about, right?
Correct.
Other post-employment benefits, but that's municipal employee retirement. Why is this such a big issue?
Well, for the league, as we've been looking at the whole system of municipal finance and how we fund local governments in Michigan, one of the key kind of areas that we've been looking at is what are the cost drivers for local budgets? And when you look at the cost drivers of a local budget, it is legacy costs. And retiree health care is the perfect example of a cost driver that's just out of control. I talked to one community in the last 2 weeks. They're looking at a 30% increase in their health insurance premiums next year. And that's the kind of stuff that on an annual basis, that's not sustainable.
30% increase. And so, all right, I mean, what can be done at the state level to try and put a handle on this? Because some in Lansing could just argue that's a local problem. You all have to deal with it.
It's not a local problem because the state has laws in place that dictate, when you talk about binding arbitration or the collective bargaining laws in the state, we have decisions where there's a case going on in Macomb County right now where the county actually went in and attempted to change drug prescription copays to lower their liability, try and get some savings out of that. And the retirees took the county to court, sued them, and the court said, no, you have to fund them at what they were. You cannot change their drug copays. So local units have no ability to fix this on their own without the state coming in and giving them some authority to do that.
Now, why did the court say no? Is it because they already had a collective bargaining agreement in place and that took precedent?
They looked at my understanding, again, not an attorney, so.
Yeah, okay.
My understanding is that they looked at statements from some of the elected officials and used media statements about the situation, and the court used those. And so I know the county is appealing that, and I know our legal defense fund is engaged to support that appeal, that we don't feel that was the right decision. But it gets back to this whole uncertainty of how does a municipality know what they're able to change? Is a $2 drug card affordable? You know, is a Blue Cross Master Medical Plan that isn't even sold on the market today, why are we still required to fund those instead of moving people to HMOs or PPOs? And those are kind of the questions that we want to ask.
So you mentioned a couple plans there. These are plans that are in existence right now in communities across the state.
We have situations across the state where someone who may have retired in 1995 or 1998 is essentially locked into the type of health plan that they had at that time. And the local unit has no ability to go in on an annual basis and manage that and make an adjustment to a copay or move them to a health plan that may have better benefits but is structured differently. We call it modernizing, you know, modern plan designs. And that's what is driving all these costs.
So give us an example of a plan that might have existed in 1992 that...
That's exactly it. You might have a retiree out there who was not required to accept Medicare. So they're still on there. They may be, you know, 68, 70 years old, still getting health care from their former employer, a $2 copay for their drug card, or maybe zero copay for their prescription drugs, and on a plan, again, plan design that isn't even offered on the market today. And those costs are astronomical for the local unit. And the local unit does not have any clear legal authority to go and put those people into a modern plan design like they have for their current employees. And that's a problem.
Medicare probably does less coverage than the plan that they're on, right? I mean, they would be going down in coverage if they went to Medicare.
Not at all. Everything that we know about Medicare and the supplemental coverage for those plans are better at or better than every plan that was out there at the time.
Now, did they pay into Medicare, though, when they were...
Our understanding is yes.
Oh.
So folks have paid into Medicare, not like the Social Security situation, but in Medicare, our understanding is folks have been paying into Medicare, but if they were not required at the time of retirement to take it, some of them are choosing not to. So you have that situation, you have these plans that are outdated and unsustainable, unaffordable, and you have a local unit that's not able on an annual basis to go in and look at those costs and try and make adjustments to keep it affordable.
But you made an agreement with these employees, right?
remember, OPEB is different than pensions. Pensions are absolutely bound in the Constitution and required to be funded, and all municipalities that have a pension obligation are required to fund those. Healthcare is not like that. Healthcare has never been required to be pre-funded. In fact, if you think about, when a health plan was given back in the 90s, what was the cost? Think about the cost of healthcare back then. It was fairly affordable. It was mm-hmm. fairly cheap when you think about it. A manager in any community around the state would give a benefit on the healthcare side 9 times out of 10 versus giving a pay raise, because it was the more affordable option. But what's happened over the last 10 to 20 years in healthcare, those costs have skyrocketed. And as those local units have found that their ability to make adjustments on those retiree plans, that's where you see the problem. They're not able to manage those costs. If we could have managed those costs, we'd be in a much different place today.
Is it too far to say that some of these municipalities will get to a point where they can't fund these anymore and just say, throw up their hands and say, sorry, guys?
I mean, look at when an emergency manager has gone into any community, what's the first thing that has gotten rid of? It's retiree health care.
Is that right?
Right. I mean, that's one of the first things that goes, because it is not required to be, unless the four corners of the contract specifically say it is lifetime guaranteed health care, there's no requirement to continue that.
So if the state government wants to make sure that these retirees, these municipal retirees, get this benefit, they're going to have to do something. But doesn't that mean that folks are going to get cut as far as their benefit goes? I mean, you're going to require folks who are on fixed incomes now to pay co-pays and take on costs that they're not taking on right now.
I look at every year how my benefits have changed at my employer, even when I was with the state. Every year things change. You didn't necessarily notice any of those changes every year. Every year the business manager or the finance director would be making adjustments and working with the health plans, getting bids for other providers. If you've got an ability to do that on an annual basis, most of these changes will go unnoticed by folks. In fact, you may even find better coverage through one of these alternatives than they currently have. So I don't see losses of benefits at all. I don't see damaging cost increases. If someone has to pay $5 for a generic drug versus free or $2, I don't view that as a huge issue. Certainly people on fixed incomes, we need to be sensitive to that, absolutely. And as our organization, talent is a huge issue for municipalities. We want good engineers. We want good water system operators. We want good police officers. So we have to be competitive, and we have to offer benefits like this. So we have to be able to continue to offer health care. That's important for us. But we have to be able to do it in a way that's sustainable long term. And the way we've got it today is not sustainable long term.
Do you think the legislature can get meaningful reforms done on OPEB this year?
Our organization is working especially hard to see if we can get that done. It's important.
All right. Chris Hackbarth, Michigan Municipal League, thanks for joining us on the podcast, and congratulations on your big fantasy football win this weekend.
Thanks, Kyle.
Hopefully I can follow suit with a W of my own. All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Special thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Chris Hackbarth, Mike Vallott, Jacob Kanzler. And, guys, we don't have the lawnmower going in the background today.
That's good, because it's raining.
That's only saving grace.
You're not supposed to mow the grass in the rain.
So we don't have that hum.
I wouldn't put it past our lawn service, though. They are dedicated.
They are pretty dedicated, even though we have enough lawn to fit in this board table. They would still go out there with their blower just to blow the random grass around our parking lot.
I wish they could come over to my house.
I would mow the lawn more often if I got to ride around on that riding lawnmower.
That is a pretty sweet lawnmower.
It is, and he uses it on a 10-foot by 10-foot square piece of lawn.
But he gets it done in 10 seconds.
Exactly.
Might take longer to make sure it's all gassed up and oiled up properly, and sure you got to climb up on top of it too. That all takes time.
To do a piece of lawn that's smaller than our board table. Oh well. That's going to do it for this week's edition of the podcast. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.